Well, hello everyone and welcome to a special budget edition of Australian Politics Live. As always, I am Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and my happiest days is when I can inform you that I'm with my producer, Miles Martignoni.
Hello.
And Miles, for the next little bit, the next few hours, is going to document what's happening inside the budget lockup.
Hello, it's budget night and the stakes are high. There are tax cuts and a promised surplus, but will it be enough to save the government?
I announce that the budget is back in the black and Australia is back on track.
Yeah. So what else needs to go into this list?
Revenue, not much.
We have got there by being restrained and disciplined when it comes to spending growth.
All that I can tell you is that there's a same-sex couple in the budget papers now, as a traditional family. Yeah. Guy and Alex live a perfect life and they're getting a tax break.
More money in your pockets, that's the promise from Treasurer Josh Frydenberg.
Well, there's a clear contest at the next election between one side of politics, which wants to reduce taxes, which are us, and the Labor Party, which want to increase taxes.
We live in an age of political disruption, like quite profound political disruption that's impacting the way politicians communicate with the electorate, the way they organise, the way they campaign, all of that stuff. But the budget is sort of one of the fixed rituals in Canberra. This is my 20th budget this year. And every budget is the same. The Treasurer has the same early morning ritual of walking into the Parliament, speaking to reporters, a photo opportunity with the budget papers and the Finance Minister. The way the day is structured and organised is exactly the same as it has been in all of that time. The ritual of the lock-up, the budget speech in the evening. It is kind of silly that we get locked up for hours at a time, all together sequestered, and then this big boom of content all emerges after the embargo is lifted. It's kind of a strange, archaic ritual. But I think governments preserve the ritual because it's in their interest. If they lock us all away, we're away from any third-party reaction. We interpret the budget on our own terms. The government gets an opportunity to explain, you know, what it's about in framing the budget, but we are shut away from the opposition political parties, from lobbyists, from stakeholders of all types. So I think that's why the government likes the ritual. It's one of the few remaining things they can control in politics anymore.
Hi, I'm Amy Ramikas, your political blogger for Guardian Australia, and we have some of the headlines the government wants you to concentrate on for this government. So, a safer and more secure Australia, that's Peter Dutton, of course. $1.88 billion on action to reduce power bills and keep the lights on, very important. Tax relief to reward and encourage hardworking Australians, and just the hardworking Australians, apparently. We're guaranteeing essential services, always a good plan. It's a plan for a stronger economy. Lower taxes for, oh look, hardworking Australians and small business. Improving the lives of Australian women. Delivering a world-class vocational education and training system. Supporting a better future for Indigenous Australians through investments in education, employment and safer communities. So that's basically life. And record investment advances long-term national health plan. Aren't we lucky? We have a safer Australia for hardworking Australians. So that's what the government wants you to concentrate on. That's basically the headline figures, and it's what you're going to hear the government tell you about over the next couple of weeks as we're in the election. Looking at the details, though, it's all very soft. It's all a little bit magical. Yes, there is a great 10-year plan, but that's as long as everything stays exactly absolutely the same as it is now, which of course we know it won't. There are problems in China. There are problems in the US. There are emerging markets. All of these international headwinds are going to have an impact on the Australian economy. The government has kind of just shuffled that off to the side and just gone, aren't the next couple of years great? And they are, because we've had iron ore and other revenue increases to pay for this. But beyond that, there's not a lot left. It's kind of, it's definitely a budget for an election. I don't think you'd see a coalition hand down a budget like this at any other time. There's not a lot left in the tank. It's all rainbows and unicorns and everyone is an absolute winner. Oprah Winfrey handing out tax cuts. You get a tax cut and you get a tax cut. There's $100 billion for infrastructure, particularly in places like Victoria and Queensland, which just coincidentally happen to be the states they need to win this election. So it's a great way of looking at the budget and the forecast in the most rosy way possible, which also means that if they lose the next election, they've got a way of saying to Labor, well, we left the budget in a great position and you guys all screwed it up.
I'm Martin Farrer. I write about business matters for The Guardian Australia, but I'm also a news editor on, as well. What I've done today is I've looked at the big headline figures that the budget has made about Australian economic growth and national debt, and looked at the assumptions that the Treasury has made in arriving at some of those figures. So, number one, the budget says that the economy is going to grow by 2.75% for the next 2 years, and then 3% for the next 2 years after that, delivering a surplus in all those years. That's the big headline number of the budget, but it seems to me that that's quite a heroic assumption that growth would be that high, because a lot of mainstream economists say that the RBA is going to have to cut interest rates because the economy is in such a weak state. So it doesn't really seem to tally with what a lot of economists think. Similarly, the government is saying that they will reduce national debt to zero in terms of percentage of GDP, which would put it in an exclusive club of one among developed nations. That's by 2030. But again, that assumes economic growth of around 3% for the next decade, which compared to other countries is unheard of. Looking at some of the other figures, the report does take quite a cautious note about house prices, which is obviously one of the bigger problems facing the economy. But at the same time, it says that any decline in house prices and resulting knock-on effect on household consumption will be offset by a likely pickup in wage growth and high spending. Now, it seems to me that that is unlikely to happen. If house prices are falling, that will affect people's income and wages. I can't see wages going up at the same time if the economy is going down and causing house prices to go down. So I think there are some quite interesting assumptions.
I see you have a standing desk now.
I'm improvising. What is that? That's like a wheelie bin. I'm just chilling here because, you know, mind your ergonomics, people, when you're in a long-haul situation. I'm just trying to avoid blood clots and a potentially life-threatening migraine by standing up and typing the first draft of my budget comment on a wheelie bin.
Hi, this is Helen Davidson, the immigration reporter. I have been looking at a couple of interesting budget items relating to refugees and the way we treat them. Turns out we can save money by not making refugees look for a job quite as quickly. Currently, we are giving them 6 months of income support before they have to join the Job Active government required mandated job hunting program. It turns out it's going to actually save about $80 million if we just give them an extra 6 months, let them learn the language, settle in, find stable living conditions, and then go and look for a job. It's better for them. Turns out it's also better for the budget by about $80 million. So that's interesting. The other thing we found is Christmas Island Detention Centre was reopened recently out of a reaction to the Medivac laws passing. The government was very angry that those Medivac laws passed. They didn't like it. They said this is going to result in all the refugees and asylum seekers from Manus Island and Nauru having to be brought in. It's going to cost $1.4 billion. We have to reopen Christmas Island. It's not going to cost $1.4 billion. They're saying they're going to close it in July. They're going to repeal the legislation, which they've always said they're going to do if they win the election, but they're also going to close the centre. And it's only going to cost $150 million this financial year and $23 million next financial year. So that's like $175 million, much, much less than $1.4 billion over 4 years.
That's quite a quick...
So because in 21-22...
This is Amy with our economics columnist, Greg Jellicoe.
$17.8 billion in surplus. Do we know why?
They're trying to figure out why the government is projecting a very optimistic jump in revenue in a few years.
Big jump in income tax in that year. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. This would be the third biggest jump in income tax in the past decade.
Okay. Are we all just working more?
Well, no. In 2021, you'll be... we're going to have an increase in wages to go from 2.75% to 3.25%.
All right, that's how wage growth hits. So
yeah, that's when the wage growth comes back. It would be the biggest one-year increase in wages growth since 2010-11, so more than a decade.
But unemployment stays the same.
And unemployment stays flat at 5, where we are basically now.
But wages are going to increase.
But wages are going to increase.
Because fairy dust?
No, we're all going to just, you know, knock down our boss's office and they're going to say,
you
know what?
And they're going to say yes.
Yeah. You have been working hard. And, I mean, a good thing is in the 2017 budget, they thought we were going to get the 3.5 in 1920.
Right.
In the 18 budget, that was pushed out to 2021.
Right.
But and now it's pushed out to 2022. We're going to get there, though.
Eventually.
We are going to get there.
Eventually you'll get the trip to Disneyland.
Yeah, it's coming.
It's not a no.
No.
I'm Gabriel Chan, and I have been assigned infrastructure captain, and I've spent the last probably 3 or 4 hours trying to work out what the $100 billion over 10 years for infrastructure is. And the first thing I discovered was it's actually $42 billion over the budget years, which is the 4 years. And the second thing I have been given is a list of what looks like every single road in Australia.
So they're really spreading that money out.
They are spreading that money out, and they're giving themselves maximum flexibility by the look of things to really wheedle into every single electorate, which might be fair given voters across Australia will be worried about their roads, but we've got a document here that is very hard to decipher. I think the bottom line is lots of money, roads, rail, everything will be sweet, everything is funded past the election date.
I'm Paul Karp, political reporter at Guardian Australia. My favourite thing about the budget is there's a whole room full of experts upstairs and no media people in between us and them. No minders. You can go up to them, bug them about any question you want. You know, for example, one thing I spotted in this year's budget is a new $580 million skills package is actually only one-tenth of that is new money. The rest of it is just cannibalising something that was already in a previous budget in another fund. And that's the kind of thing that you only find out when you've got everyone captive upstairs and no minders to stop you. I've been looking at income tax cuts this budget, and the long and the short of that is the low-income earners and middle-income earners will get a tax cut of up to $550 this year. But then in a few years' time in 2024, it really kicks in for people earning $40,000 to $200,000 and more. So that's middle to high income earners. And so they have to wait a little longer, but they get a lot more when they get there. So a bit of a pre-budget boost for the low to middle income earners. I've also been looking at the small business asset write-off, which is when they buy a new asset, they get to deduct the tax immediately rather than over the years that they have an asset. That already got $750 million in January, and there's another $400 million to expand that in the budget. And, you know, Lenore and I were just saying then that that's just a straight up shoveling cash out the door way of stimulating the economy, because they get a bigger tax deduction, they have more money to spend. That's just a straight up way of just giving it a shot in the arm to the economy.
I'm First Dog on the Moon, Walkley award-winning cartoonist for The Guardian Australia.
How much do you love the budget lockup and your technical problems?
Get away from me.
John Kadelka wouldn't be complaining.
It's awful, and we all suffer horribly. It was better in, what was it, 2015? That was the Abbott hockey budget. That was a classic. We all remember that one. We all still stand around. Well, we don't have urns anymore. We stand around the coffee cart talking about that budget because nobody could believe it. But this one, this is a budget. It's not even a budget. It's just a series of election promises and a list of roads. and I just want to go and lie down, and I'm going to burst into tears.
Do you want to take it away, Murph?
Oh, no, I think the boss should take it away, shouldn't you?
Right.
Well, I think we should say who's here.
Well, Lenore Taylor, editor of Guardian Australia.
The aforementioned boss.
Yep. Greg Jericho, economics blogger, graph writering person.
Fact man, fact Guardian man. Australia. And fact man's wing woman, Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia.
All of us are going slightly mad at the 6.5 hour mark of the budget lockup.
I think we're holding up rather well, actually.
No, I'm not.
Yes.
Perfect climate for the question. What was the point of this budget?
The election was the point of this budget. You know, like at this point in the political cycle, they want to corral the debate into the stuff that they want to talk about. The government wants to talk about they're good economic managers in their view. They've got a surplus. There's the evidence. They want to not talk about all those services things that Labor wants to talk about. So they've tried to sort of cover them off. They want to talk about roads. They want to talk about stuff they're doing in the suburbs. My question is whether they've really done enough to give themselves election talking points, if you're looking at it from the point of view of political objectives. There was another undercurrent in this budget, though, which was the economic objectives. It was a stimulatory budget. You know, there was an instant asset write-off there for small business. There was tax cuts. That's all the kind of stuff the Rudd government used to do in the financial crisis. I mean, it's not that bad. We're not in a downturn like that. But the economy's kind of weak, and they didn't talk about that. But I think there is an unspoken economic point, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think one of the other aims of this budget is to almost put in a few little time bombs for a Labor government, should a Labor government win elections, such as the path that the budget papers notionally set towards paying off debt in 10 years, which is only going to happen if there's a very, with a very rosy set of numbers that are unlikely to occur. And if they were to occur, a beautiful recession-free decade, it would require at some point someone actually having to spend a bit of money to really get some stimulus flowing, and that's going to, of course, hit net debt. So despite the fact that the budget papers are forecasting Chinese growth to slow, America's growth to slow, we're all still trundling along nicely, and I think it's a case of the government wanting, it's an election budget, but also it's we probably are going to lose this election budget, so let's at least go out with a bit of a fairy tale of we left the budget in a wonderful shape, and if anything, actually, if reality comes along, oh, well, that's all Labor's fault.
We'll set the bar high.
Yeah.
Yeah, I slightly sort of demur from Greg there a bit. I don't think that the government is forecasting a loss with this budget, although I suppose you could look at it in that way. I think this budget is like the structural underpinning of what they hope will be their recovery. This is a budget that can either work as a pathway to victory or as a sandbagging exercise. We've got to look at who the government's talking to in this budget. Who are they talking to? You know, in 2016, Scott Morrison handed down his first budget as Treasurer. He offered nothing for workers on average incomes. That was a pre-election budget. The government went to the election in 2016. We know what happened. They almost lost. This budget, Scott Morrison is talking to the voters most at risk of casting a protest vote in the coming election campaign, workers on average incomes, who are jack of all the nonsense in Canberra, who are sick of the soap opera and the intrigues, who have been on the receiving end of stagnant wages, economic insecurity, all of that sort of stuff. This is a pitch squarely to them in a way that I have not seen the Coalition do at any point previously during this period in government. So Scott Morrison is hoping that this direct pitch to the voters at risk of voting for independents or the far-right fringe parties that the government is most at risk of leaking votes to, start to listen. I totally agree with Lenore. I don't think that this is nearly close enough to a big bang in order to reset the political debate. Labor remains the favourites to win this election. And I agree with Lenore, there's not enough sizzle here to really reset that political conversation. However, there is a strategy here, and it's pretty obvious what the strategy is.
I think they were probably, in preparing the budget, a bit caught. Like, they had to deliver a surplus. They'd set that standard for themselves. Economic credibility is their big thing. If they didn't deliver a surplus, you know, that whole point of difference would be lost. But then they didn't quite have enough leeway to do a lot of other stuff. So they did some things, but like the tax cut for low income earners, that's pretty much just matching what Labor's already promised. So that's not like, we'll stop talking about that maybe sort of sometime next week, unless there's more that we don't know about yet. So it's hard to see what is the big conversation starter. Roads, it would seem. Roads, the big conversation starter?
Roads, massive conversation starter, like $100 billion over 10 years conversation starter, although $42 billion actually over the forward estimates that we can
and
actually bank.
I mean, it's spending on roads and infrastructure, it's good. And certainly from an economic point of view and even just a nation kind of building point of view, to use that terrible phrase, it's worthwhile spending. But I don't even think in this budget it's sort of would have people, you know, whistling and going, wow, that's
a big thing. I mean, it does give you a point of contact. Like, I get it, you get the shits when you're stuck in traffic. Like, that is a point of kind of contact. Yeah. But I don't know, do people go, I know why I want to vote the government? Yeah. Because roads.
Well, no, I said no one ever. Except I think Scott Morrison at the moment has in the back of his mind a couple of incumbent premiers who were Daniel Andrews. He's actually taken to standing so close to Daniel Andrews, it's sort of rather disturbing. But he has in his mind Daniel Andrews won in Victoria at the end of last year on a bunch of very garden variety infrastructure delivery type on that sort of a pitch.
But he was the state government responsible for roads.
Yes. Mm. I'm not over-egging this. I'm really desperately not over-egging this. But in the Prime Minister's mind, he sees incumbency as a benefit in the current political cycle.
Which is true.
Which has been road-tested in a couple of recent election contests in Victoria and New South Wales. Incumbency is a benefit. The projection of something approximating competence in incumbency, also a benefit. I think that's rather more challenging for this government, because with Andrews, he could campaign on level crossings because he got rid of a lot of them. He could campaign on roads and various things delivered because he'd done it. Look, this government's built infrastructure as well, but voters still know that the lion's share of the past two terms in government on the part of the Coalition has been more consumed by jihads, infighting, and you know, bursts of incompetence than anything else.
And any message on roads or whatever else, is the success of it is predicated on the voters still listening.
Mm. Exactly. Yeah, I don't think this isn't a budget that's going to hurt them. I think I think
they need a lot better than not hurt them.
Yeah, and also for those who are still havering, I think they'll almost look at this and go, took you long enough almost to get here. This is the kind of budget that people were crying out for in 2016, 2017, that real sort of where the low wages growth was already biting and this government seemed oblivious to it. And now it's like, oh, you've finally worked out that there are people.
That's right. They are so late to the party on that stuff. It's not funny. But if we think about the journey this government's gone on from 2014, that first Tony Abbott Joe Hockey budget, to now, it's like it's,
yeah,
it's
well incredible. That's a road.
Well, that is a road.
Thanks for listening. You can find all of our budget coverage at theguardian.com. If you like the podcast, tell your friends. Smurf will be back next week to probably cover an election campaign.